Get around, get around, get around.
I get around, round, 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 I get around. It's been stuck in my head all day.
I could do the baritone for you.
I get stuck driving up and down the same old streets.
No. You might be renting out your house to strangers, but are you ready to let strangers drive your car? We're going to be talking about a new service that offers that very promise, and it's launching in Seattle. Plus, a new feature of Seattle's Space Needle lets you float, or at least seem like you're floating, 520 feet above the ground. And an epic week for startup fundings. Hundreds of millions of dollars poured into Seattle area startups. We'll explain what it all means coming up this week on GeekWire. From GeekWire.com in Seattle, I'm editor Todd Bishop.
I'm life sciences reporter and podcast producer Claire McGrain.
I'm startups and sports tech reporter Taylor Soper.
And I'm Geek Life reporter Kurt Schlosser.
Yeah, Kurt, you got to do the Space Needle.
That's right.
Walk. We'll talk about that a little bit later on. But first, I want to talk about Get Around. We've all been in here singing the Beach Boys based on the name of this company, but it's actually a San Francisco-based startup, and it essentially is Airbnb for cars. The reason we're talking about it here is they just launched in Seattle this week. This is fascinating to me. I think people had a hard time wrapping their heads around the idea of letting strangers into their house. I feel even stranger personally about letting somebody into my car. We'll get into that, but let's talk about how this works. Essentially, if you have a car, you can put it up to be driven by people just as you would do this on Airbnb. So this service is already launched in markets including Los Angeles and San Francisco, and they report that people who rent their vehicles out on the service make about $500 per month for an average of about $6,000 annually. So if you think about that in the context of what you might bring home in salary, I mean, it's a nice little, it's a vacation, basically. It's essentially Get Around. The startup takes a 40% cut of the revenue, and this is essentially truly a car sharing service. So it's going to compete with the Reach Nows and the Car to Go's of the world. And they've already got, as of this recording, about 60 to 70 cars available for rent in Seattle. If you have an older car, they're able to essentially retrofit it with a kit that allows people to unlock it and get your keys and drive around. With newer cars, essentially, people are able to use those kind of cloud services that let you open the doors. So what do you think of this?
I might be a little biased because I just bought a new car, but this freaks me out. I would not let people drive my car.
I'm interested to hear why you think the car is more freaky than the house. I would think the house is more weird than the car. Car is just small little four-wheeler. Your house is like your home where someone is going to like sleep in your, you know, in your bed and use your bathroom. But I totally understand. Like when I first just read this story on GeekWire, I was like, I would never do this with my own car, but maybe that's what people said when Airbnb first launched.
I think with my Airbnb experience, at least as a renter, as an occupant, I've been in a lot of situations where I'm in more of a mother-in-law, where it's separated from the rest of the house. And so me personally, as somebody, if I was going to let somebody into my house and there was a separation like that between the rented space and the rest of the house, then I'm more comfortable with it. I get what you're saying. I think it's very similar, the whole idea of letting somebody into your whole house and letting somebody drive around your car. But I have a hard time with the notion of just letting them drive around, because what if they don't come back, right? No, I know that is addressed. Obviously, Get Around has insurance and everything like that. But still, that whole concept is a little troubling.
Yeah, you know, I think I'm flip-flopping on this as we sit here. Initially, I'm very particular about my car, the inside of my car. In a parking lot, I don't want anybody near my car. If you get the inclination that someone has been messing with your car, you get very upset. It's a big-ticket item. But you know, as I think about it more from the standpoint of how your car sits there all day unused and what a waste that is, especially in a city where there are already so many vehicles and such a traffic issue, it makes sense. And I started commuting by bike about 2 weeks ago, and I go home and I see my Jeep sitting there and it's got bird poop on it and the windshield's all covered in pollen. And I'm like, somebody should be driving that. Maybe I'd think that that should be my wife or somebody else, but not a stranger. And this sounds interesting to me.
Well, to that point, I mean, a lot of these sharing economy apps and services are about creating efficiencies, about taking the things we already have in the world and just using them to a greater degree. So this is a classic example in that way. The pricing is actually really interesting for people who are driving it. And Taylor, I know we're sending you out to test this service after we record here. So we'll have to get your report on a subsequent GeekWire podcast, or people will have to re-GeekWire. But it costs about $5 per hour for a basic sedan. Or if you want a Porsche, for example, you can spend up to $20 per hour. So
I'm going for that. Although I don't really know how to drive stick. What if I get in a car and I don't know how to drive the stick?
That's a good question. I would assume that most of these are automatic. Wouldn't you think?
Porsche, probably not. But
hopefully it would tell you, like give you some info on, oh, this is a four-wheel drive, it's got stick, it's got this many seats before you pay to use it.
Yeah, so many what ifs.
What if the person, is there a requirement for that person to have their car be in a certain condition, on inside and out? Like, would you want to borrow a car that is all crummy inside and has an ashtray full of cigarette butts and that sort of thing? I mean, seems like just like an Airbnb apartment, car would have to meet some specifications.
Absolutely. And we should say that there's a whole list of guidelines for people who are going to rent out their cars. And so it is very similar to Airbnb in that way. And also there's rules for Uber drivers in terms of how new their car needs to be and that sort of thing. So this has done well in the markets where it's launched, and now it's here in Seattle. I'm going to be really interested to see, Taylor, just what your experience is like.
Yeah, this is really fascinating. And I mean, investors are betting big on it. They've raised $85 million to date. And it's really challenging our notion of how comfortable are we with sharing, you know? But if you look at what's happened to Uber and Airbnb when they first started out, you know, as these companies grow, I think they start to learn how it works and how customers interact with it. And then they develop rules and assurance, and it works. So this will be interesting. To Kurt's point, and also in our story, is the more people, you know, take public transit or take Uber and Lyft, and they also have this car just sitting there, it makes sense for a service like this to get going.
Well, it also plays into the larger discussion we've had about housing and greater density. If you're able to rely as a population on a lesser number of cars and vehicles overall, that really helps the infrastructure, at least in terms of parking and everything like that.
Yeah, I read that report in the Seattle Times today about the population density in Seattle and how the 114,000 people have moved here in the last 7 years or so. It's the fastest growing city over the last decade in the country. Imagine if those 114,000 people all brought their own car. That's a lot of traffic on an already stressed ecosystem.
Speaking of Seattle's growth, Kurt, if somebody wanted to view and get a vantage point of the boom happening in this city, there's probably no better place than the Space Needle, which is where you were this week experiencing one of the new features of this iconic landmark.
Yeah, if you've been in and around Seattle lately and have looked up at the city's most famous landmark, you've noticed that it's been wrapped in a scaffolding for months now, and that wrapping is coming off. And beneath that is the exciting part of this renovation project that they call the Century Project. $100 million they're spending over multiple years, and the first phase of that is starting to be revealed to the public. And I went up and sat on these new glass benches, which, you know, sitting on a bench at the Space Needle doesn't sound very exciting. But the gist of it is that they're pitched at such an angle that you lean back and your back is against a glass panel. So there's nothing separating you from falling 520 feet, but 2.5 inches of glass.
Which hopefully they've reinforced. And I'm thinking of that. When I was watching your video and you were having some of the tourists lean back and check it out. In fact, can we listen to that right now?
So we've got a couple of the first visitors up here to experience the glass benches. What are your names? Where are you from?
Ed and Yvonne. We're from Scotland.
Scotland.
From Scotland. First time in Seattle?
Yes. Yeah. Arrived yesterday.
Beautiful.
And the Space Needle was on your list of places to visit?
Yeah, it's the first thing, really. So, iconic Seattle, so we came up straight away.
Yvonne, you looked a little apprehensive. Are you afraid of heights?
A little bit. I'm a little bit afraid of heights. And then, also, the elevator off is really cool with the glass. But, I have a slight fear of them. But it's really cool once you're here.
You're still not all the way back.
Yeah, I still quite got the nerve. Oh, my goodness.
Go for it. Go for it.
Oh, my gosh. It is really cool. I'd recommend it.
That seemed kind of dangerous. I mean, this thing just opened. Were you at all worried about encouraging these tourists to lean against the glass?
I got to say, this job has given me the opportunity to do things that I never thought that I would do before from a height and a depth standpoint. Oh, yeah. I mean, I was up in the Needle last fall when we climbed down into the scaffolding and it was completely open to the air. And I've been underground in the tunnel. That is a little creepy in its own right. You know, the thing...
The new waterfront tunnel that's going along, replacing the viaduct, yeah.
So for some reason today, I was just like, yeah, sit back, lean back. And I knocked my head against the glass and put my hands up on it and knocked on it and got the 7-year-old girl to do it, who was completely scared before she sat down with me.
So we've helped you overcome some of the challenges in your personal life.
And in turn, I pass that on to tourists in Seattle. People were great. There was a lot of people. As you would imagine, if you fly in here and you're about to take a cruise out of here, which is very popular this time of year to Alaska, those are the people that are at the top of the Needle, especially this week. And, you know, they're enamored with the city and the views. And the cool thing was that there were painters outside the glass tethered to the halo that runs around the Needle, and they're painting it the galaxy gold, which was the color 56 years ago when the Needle opened for the World's Fair. So those guys are standing out there and they're laughing at the people on the other side of the glass who are like standing 2 feet back. They don't want to get too close to that height. So it's a neat experience right now. And by July 4th, it's going to get even better, because a level below the observation deck is where the restaurant is, the rotating restaurant. And that's where a glass floor has been installed. And it'll be the world's first rotating glass floor restaurant.
That sounds so breakable.
So you can eat, you can look down at your feet and all the way down to the ground below and see the Museum of Pop Culture and everything going on below the city. This is a big deal for the Needle. They say we already have the best views, now we have the most thrilling views. So it's quite a transformation.
That's awesome. All right, good stuff. So we've got to sort of overcome our fears here.
For $29.
Hundreds of feet up in the air, or letting others drive our car around town. I don't know which is more concerning. But all right, so that is a rundown of a couple of the news highlights from this past week. Coming up, there have been hundreds of thousands of dollars invested in Seattle startups over the past week, just the past week alone. We're going to be talking about who got the money and what they're going to be doing with it. Coming up next on GeekWire. All right, welcome back. It's Todd Bishop with Claire McGrain, Taylor Soper, and Kurt Schlosser. It's the GeekWire reporting team here, a portion of it, talking about the week's news. Thanks for joining us. I have to say, Taylor, we were talking on the weekend, chatting on Slack, and we realized, at least I realized, wait a second, we've gotten word about a crush of startup fundings, just tens and tens of millions of dollars being put into startups in the Seattle region being announced this past week. I can't remember a week like this when there's been this much money invested in this array of startups in the Seattle region. Can you, in like the 5 years you've been doing this?
Dollar bills, y'all.
Have you been waiting to say that entire time? So.
Anyways, a lot of money going in the Seattle startup ecosystem. You know, there, I guess we have some theories of why that's happening now, but you know, it could be maybe an impending economic downturn. Possibly they're trying to raise all their money now. But at the same time, we've seen a bunch of IPOs, you know, this year. So it's kind of hard to say, is this the coincidence or is this a pattern here?
So let's talk about some of the companies that got money. The biggest round was raised by Rover, which is the pet sitting startup.
Oof, oof.
So they raised $155 million. I love this company's story. They were started as an idea at a startup weekend. And for people who don't know what that is, essentially one person gets up or a couple people get up, they pitch their idea to the crowd. And then if other people like that idea, they sort of assemble around it and they work on it for the weekend. That's what happened with Rover. It was a venture capitalist by the name of Greg Gottesman who pitched this idea. And the whole idea is that you can find somebody to take care of your dog, but I know they're expanding in a lot of different ways.
Yeah, Rover is, you know, started as a simple idea at a startup weekend event and had a lot of naysayers in the beginning. You know, this is not a real business. It's this marketplace of matching pet owners with pet sitters. You can't make a lot of money off this. But year after year, they've kind of proven the haters wrong. And now they're one of the, you know, highest valued companies in the Pacific Northwest. And they're expanding to Europe later this year. They're going to possibly roll out new services, whether it's vet services, grooming, all kind of using this underbelly of technology, the cloud, mobile. If you look at the pet industry, CEO Aaron Easterly was telling me that the pet industry continues to grow. I mean, if you look outside, go over to Amazon and see how many dog owners there are. But at the same time, the pet industry really hasn't had the same impact of technology as other consumer industries. And so basically the folks at Rover saw this opportunity, so they saw the gap, and they've really created what is now the behemoth in this pet sitting space.
So they're valued at close to $1 billion. They're not quite at $1 billion. But this is essentially a real surprise in a lot of ways, because you would expect this company to do an IPO. So why didn't they go public like we've seen so many other companies lately?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, $155 million is a massive round. And
it's more than Smartsheet raised in their IPO.
Exactly. And so, you know, and we've seen Smartsheet, Avalara, DocuSign go public this year. So it was like, why isn't Rover going public? Well, the CEO was basically saying that they've got more or less a lot of risky bets coming up. They're expanding out to all these new verticals, and they're not sure if it's going to work tomorrow or next month or even maybe next year. So they want that extra flexibility, and it's a little more comfortable to have investors that say, hey, we'll wait 2 to 5 years instead of we want to see a return next year. And so for Rover, I mean, you know, it makes sense why they raised this, you know, from the private markets, and maybe eventually down the line they will go public. But I think, you know, when they look at their projections and their forecasts, private market made sense. So they've got a ton of cash in the bank. I don't think they've even used much of their last round, which they raised last year. So really interesting company. They're going to hire another 100 people this year. They already have like 300 in Seattle. So who would have thought, you know, startup weekend, let's help people take care of their dogs. And now it's this massive tech company.
It is interesting, Taylor, the way Rover got started there with such a small idea. And, you know, the whole pet sitting thing, the Airbnb thing, the gig economy sharing, mobile, all that, as it, you know, it just keeps regenerating itself. I met with David Adams, another young entrepreneur, a week or two ago. He started a company called Sniff Spot here in Seattle, and they connect pet owners with people who want to rent out their backyard, essentially, so that the pet has a place to play.
It's like the Airbnb for backyards for pets.
Essentially, if you live in a tower apartment or whatever, and you don't want to go to a dog park where your dog might not get along with other dogs, you just connect with a person who's listed their house, and you go hang out for half an hour for like $7.
And then you rent their car and you drive your dog home on Get Around. Jeez. No, that's it's interesting to see how the excess capacity is basically being sliced up there. Another company that raised a ton of money this past week, a Seattle company called Outreach, and they do sales automation. So they help salespeople and others essentially automate their workflow and use artificial intelligence and other things like that to know when to contact people, to contact them on their behalf. You've probably received some of these automated emails, for example, that are following up as if they were the person, and they're not really the person. It's sort of the AI agent acting on their behalf at the moment that they think you'll respond at the right time. So they do sales automation. And this is Manny Medina, who is the CEO there. So they raised $65 million. The round was led by Spark Capital. Interesting thing here, though, is Taylor, you called him up, talked to him, interviewed him. The first thing he wanted to talk about was not this big round. It was something else, right?
It wasn't their employee growth. It wasn't their balance sheet. It was Seattle's head tax, which by now, if you've been listening to the podcast or reading the news, you know what that is in Seattle. And he was not very happy with the head tax as it pertains to the impact on his business, which, you know, if you look at their growth and how much money they're making, probably not going to destroy the company. But you know, he did say that they're thinking about, you know, their next 20 or 50 developers. And if there's going to be this tax in Seattle, they might just go across the water and go to Bellevue and open an office.
No, let's be clear here. When they're raising $65 million, they are not making that money. They are raising funds and giving away equity in exchange for that money. So, but are they actually making enough revenue as a company to qualify for the head tax? Because that's $20 million in annual revenue in Seattle. Did he talk about that?
He wouldn't reveal the revenue numbers, but yeah, definitely they're taking money from investors is different from what's on your balance sheet. But I think the fact that investors are betting so big that this company is going to continue to grow, and he was very angry. He called it a punch in the gut, this head tax to his company, which maybe statistically by the numbers is not, you know, literally going to like bring this company to the ground. But I think he was basically sending a message to Seattle City Council. Why are you punishing the fruits of our labor? We're giving the city jobs. We're becoming a center of technology excellence. And now you're saying that's bad.
Right. It was really interesting. One of his comments was, we're never going to become the next Silicon Valley if this happens. And a lot of the responses were, great, we don't want to become the next Silicon Valley, because obviously people have positive and negative connotations with Silicon Valley, the huge growth of the tech sector, and also the downsides in terms of the homelessness, the housing inaffordability, the traffic, everything that comes in terms of a negative with that. We should point out, we talked a lot about this topic on last week's show. After we recorded that episode, a business coalition representing many of Seattle's largest employers launched a new effort, a campaign to overturn that law called No Tax on Jobs. So we've had a whole new twist there in that realm. I think both sides here have really valid points. We need to do something to address the issue of homelessness. The business community obviously feels like the head tax isn't the right thing. To me, the key thing here is not going to be this referendum to overturn the legislation, but the initiative to do something different to solve the problem. And I think that's what's on the business community now, is to come up with the actual solution, not just the opposition to what's going on. All right, so back to our rundown of all the money. Another one that raised a big round of funding, $35 million, is Tango Card, which is a digital rewards platform. And then, Kurt, you covered CrowdCow?
CrowdCow, GeekWire Awards Startup of the Year this year, just a couple weeks ago. I've been following these guys for going on 3 years now, and this is their biggest round. They had a seed round of about $2 million in the beginning of 2017. So again, Madrona involved here, a couple big names, Ashton Kutcher as an investor, Joe Montana. So they are expanding. They're more than just beef now. They're into chicken. They're into pork. They've gone national. So they are definitely on a high growth trajectory.
This whole thing started as like a Kickstarter for cows, basically, where you would buy a portion of a cow. But it sounds like it's gotten much bigger than that.
Yeah. So they did a proof of concept when they first launched and tipped a cow, as they called it, in 24 hours. So there was obviously high interest in this ability to get any cut that you wanted from ranchers that were using sustainable practices.
So that's on one end of the spectrum. And then we've also had biotech fundings recently. There's a company called Nola Therapeutics, right? And this, when you wrote about this, Claire, it struck me, this could be one of the next big ones. I don't know. It seems like they're onto something as well.
Yeah, I think so. And obviously their investors think the same. So they raised a $45 million round. So that brings their total funding up to $100 million. And their clinical trial data is looking really good. Basically, they announced some more data this week. And what they do is they do a slight variation of a bone marrow transplant for leukemia. The variation being that instead of using somebody's donated bone marrow, they use blood from umbilical cords. Nobody's using that. So you can donate the blood from umbilical cords. And in the long run, it's actually a really, really great treatment for leukemia and other blood cancers. But there are certain problems with it. So Colleen Delaney, who is the founder of NOLA, when she was a researcher at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center, all her work was around making that process safer and more effective. And it seems like they are doing that. So basically, they've got a pretty good idea. It seems like it's following through and they've got enough money to keep moving on it.
Yeah. So, Taylor, you alluded to this at the beginning. This could either be a sign that the economy is booming and all these companies are doing well and attracting investor money, or it could be a sign that these companies are basically stocking up to survive a downturn. You could look at it both ways.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if it's a coincidence or there's something going on here that, you know, we don't know about, but I think there's just a lot of activity in Seattle right now and a lot of entrepreneurs building cool technology and attracting investor interest, not just in Seattle, but from the Valley as well. I mean, we're looking at companies like Outreach and Rover raising these massive rounds, largely from outside of Seattle. So a lot of eyes on the entrepreneurial activity here in town.
All right. We will be right back with the Random Channel. Thanks for listening. All right. Welcome back. It is time for the Random Channel, that moment of the week when we talk about all the random items we were buzzing about behind the scenes this week at GeekWire. Kurt?
I'll start. I'll get the good news out of the way. the president, Donald Trump, lost a court ruling this week when a U.S. District federal judge ruled that it was unconstitutional for him to block people he disagreed with on Twitter. Have any of you been blocked by the president?
Not yet.
Tweeted far away from
the president? I've been blocked by other people, though. I have. I know. Yes. Have you ever like gone to somebody's Twitter and realized that they blocked you?
I don't think I have.
Yeah, I don't even want to talk about who it is because it's like, but hey, it's not a good feeling. I can imagine being blocked by the president would not be the maybe it would be sort of a sign of victory.
Yeah, a lot of folks took it as a badge of honor, to get somebody who's got 52 million followers to go ahead and block you, or one of his minions would block you. Anyway, this was a case that started about a year ago. Several Twitter users and the Columbia University Knight First Amendment Institute brought this suit and essentially said it's a free speech issue, and the fact that he is the president and he's tweeting quite often about government affairs, he shouldn't deny people the ability to read that stuff and to interact with that type of information. You know, it's not all just making fun of Rosie O'Donnell. He does break news on Twitter, and he's been doing it. Well, he hasn't been breaking news since 2009, but he's been on the platform for that long.
And what he says is, by definition, often news, such Correct. As this past week when he said that he hereby ordered the Justice Department to look into the possible surveillance of his campaign.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think this is a really interesting First Amendment problem, because obviously when the Constitution was written, nobody imagined that a public place could be a virtual place on the internet. So it's really interesting to see how these kind of constitutional and legal problems are interacting with something as seemingly kind of whimsical and fun as Twitter.
As whimsical and fun as Donald Trump's, as real Donald Trump.
Well, maybe not. Maybe whimsical and fun are the wrong problems. Casual and
informal.
Yeah, breezy. Informal. Yes, informal.
Yeah, if you're missing out on the fun, follow along at real Donald Trump.
All right. Well, you know what got my attention this week? And actually, I wasted, I think, probably about 30 collective hours among the team bouncing my idea off. I still haven't published this. I need to publish it. There's a story in the Seattle Times about how the people who came up with the original billboard in Seattle that said, "Will the last person leaving Seattle turn out the lights?" This was back in 1971, of course, during the Boeing bust. And they mentioned, this has come up as part of the whole head tax debate, where the iron workers in particular said the city council wanted to basically turn out the lights again. That was the whole gist of what they were saying. And the people who came up with this billboard are talking about bringing it back.
Wow.
And so I thought, well, you can't just bring back the original. You got to update it for 2018. And so I've been working. I've been doing like my Microsoft Paint magic. And my whole idea, I took the car that was there and I put a Tesla over it. And then it did say, "Will the last person leaving Seattle turn out the lights?" And my new version is, "Will the last person leaving Amazon HQ1 tell Alexa to turn out the lights?" So I think That's still need to get this on the site.
Maybe you should tweet that and see if anybody blocks you.
Exactly. I think that's quite possible. Do you take offense to that? I'm not trying to make political commentary here. I'm merely trying to update the sign in the spirit of what they want to do.
I think that would be a trip to, if that billboard came back to a city where there are thousands of people moving every month, that would be quite the height of irony.
You know what? I was trying to figure out what the little image is in the billboard, and I just figured it out. It's a light bulb. Maybe I need to replace that with something modern as well. Like an Echo. Yeah, there we go. Okay. I got some more tweaks to do in Microsoft Paint. Paint 3D, man. Pretty damn cool. All right.
Your visual item is quite the hit on radio.
Yes, exactly.
Go to geekwire.com
to see it. Trust me, it's amazing.
Can't wait to see your masterpiece.
All right. Claire?
I want to talk about Grimes. Do any of you know Grimes?
Elon Musk's new girlfriend?
Yeah, she is one of my favorite musical artists.
What?
So for those of you like Todd who look very confused, Grimes is this really, really weird and good electronic artist from Canada. She's very experimental, very like outside the box, artsy, and she's dating billionaire capitalist Elon Musk. It's just a weird matchup.
So can we listen to some of her music?
Yeah, it's bizarre. Hold on, let me get you some.
Is it spatial, like spacey? Is that why he's into it?
I think it's because it's what you would hear on Mars. You know, he's all about Mars. Everything's about getting to Mars. This is what he wants his sort of Mars experience to be like.
Maybe a redo on the David Bowie
Oh, yeah.
Soundtrack that went off into space in the Tesla.
All right. So just imagining those two as a couple is hard to wrap your mind
around. It's hard to wrap my mind around. The more I think about it, the more sense it makes. And then I think about it more and it doesn't make any sense again. I don't know. I've just been fascinated with this and has half the internet, apparently.
Nice.
I also got a Chrome plugin that replaces the word Elon Musk with Grimes' boyfriend.
Wow.
Which,
like in any random webpage?
Yeah, well, we read about him a lot. So occasionally I'll go to GeekWire and I'm like, oh, we're writing about Grimes' boyfriend today. Great.
I got nothing for you. Although Amazon has had a couple troubling headlines in the news this week. I saw one woman was charged $7,000 for toilet paper, got a refund 2 months later. Not as exciting. And then I just saw this story about a Portland family who apparently had their conversation recorded by Alexa, and that conversation was sent to a random person in Seattle who was on their contact list.
Was it about that person?
I don't know if Alexa's that smart, but I don't know. I don't know. Amazon's apparently investigating. Cairo stood outside of a TV station here in Seattle, stood outside of the spheres and had their 11 o'clock news Alexa accused of eavesdropping. So,
all right, that's it for GeekWire this week. For Claire McGrain, Taylor Soper, and Kurt Schlosser, I am Todd Bishop. We'll talk to you next time on GeekWire. Thanks for listening to the GeekWire podcast. If you're not already, you should subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast app. Just search GeekWire, all one word, in Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. If you like what we do, consider leaving us a rating and a review. It really helps other people find the show. You can see more of our coverage at geekwire.com. Claire McGrain produces the show. Thanks for tuning in, everyone. See you next time.